thought about Elizabeth. I get the impression that she's genuinely confused, which bothers her. Her confusion is probably caused by all the drugs she's on, but I cannot see her being involved in anything as hideous as the killings. I'm also certain that she'd remain loyal to Benedict Broom with her dying breath if necessary. She might be a Fruit Loop, but I swear she's not deliberately lying. This was pretty much what Marie had thought. But the urgent need to find the killer left her with little patience for playing guessing games. If she needs interviewing again, Rosie, I suggest you go alone. I think you'll get more from her. The young woman smiled. I think your rank put her off, Sarge. I noticed that she didn't like the doctor either, although she was fine with the nurse and me. I would say she has a problem with authority figures. I wonder what her problem is. Why is she such a nervous wreck? Marie turned into a side road and doubled back to the station. Maybe I'll ask Broom. If he's been spending his precious time taking her for outpatient appointments, I'm willing to bet he knows exactly what is wrong with her. As they stepped through the doors into the station foyer, Marie heard someone call out her name. Jackman was beckoning her over to where Superintendent Ruth Crook was talking animatedly with a tall, slim man with a neatly trimmed beard and dark-rimmed glasses.
Ah, good. Sergeant Evans, just in time to meet Professor Henry O'Byrne. He's the friend of Professor Rory Wilkinson that you were expecting.
Marie did a double-take, giving Jackman a sideways glance. The super was actually smiling at the man, and in an uncharacteristically warm manner. Coincidentally, he's an old acquaintance. Henry is a respected psychologist, an expert in the area of serious child abuse. She gave him an admiring smile. He has worked on some of this country's most difficult cases, and now he's all yours, because I'm afraid I have a meeting. She looked at Jackman. The press have cottoned on to the activity around the hospital morgue. I have to give them something, but I'll do my best to say as little as I can. She shook her head, then hurried away, calling out, But it won't be long before the balloon goes up, so be prepared. It had to happen. It always did. Marie shook the professor's hand. His smile was warm and engaging. Jackman had told her that Rory had called him gorgeous in a mature way. Marie could see what he meant.
Let's go up to my office, Professor, said Jackman. It's quieter there, and the coffee's better.
First they took him to the murder room, and as he appraised the photographs, they gave him a brief summary of what had happened. For what seemed like an age, Henry O'Byrne walked up and down, staring at details and then standing back to take in the whole picture. Finally, he followed them into Jackman's office.
I know it's asking a lot, sir, but could you give us some kind of profile on the sort of person who could do something like this?
Marie didn't know how much time this man was prepared to give, but the question was worth asking.
Well, much as I enjoy the TV crime series, I have to tell you that I don't believe offender profiling actually works in real life. It is not truly reliable, and it can be quite dangerous if interpreted incorrectly. I know the FBI Behavioral Science Unit in their bunker down below Quantico would disagree, but the percentages are on my side. No matter what the dramatists tell you, there is only a small chance of getting an arrest through profiling. In some cases, you might just as well draw the names out of a hat.
He looked at them, unapologetically.
I can see you're disappointed, but you'd be better getting your man or woman with good solid police work and the support of a good pathologist and his laboratory.
He peered at them over the top of his glasses.
But what I can do is advise you using straightforward psychology, the science of mind and behavior. And that can be very informative indeed.
Great. Jackman's face lit up. I can live with that. And to be truthful, I totally agree. And if it was okay with Jackman, it was fine by her. Marie nodded, and her mood lightened considerably.
So, what would you like to know? Asked Jackman.
Might I see the crime scene? I need to be there, to breathe the air and see everything that the killer would have seen.
You sound like Rory. He likes to be first on scene and have some time alone with the corpses. He says they often share their secrets with him.
I totally understand that. But then, we do share a lot of similar traits. The professor grinned at them. It's always the nice-looking men, isn't it? Marie thought.
I'll take you out to the scene as soon as I've checked on my team. Jackman stood up. Are you up for a ride into the misty marshes?
Henry beamed at Jackman. Oh, yes.
Rosie was just hanging up the phone as Marie approached her desk.
Philip Grove's veterinary nurse says that several of the animals in their rescue center do have name cards on their cages. Elizabeth Sewell does spend time there on a voluntary basis helping with the rescued animals, and it was Elizabeth who wrote the name plaques.
Hmm.
Doesn't sound like the sort of thing a killer would be interested in, does it? I'm certain she's not involved, Sarge. She's done them for someone else, and I'll bet she has no idea what they were for. That may be the case, but it would be helpful if she could remember who the hell asked her to do them. And sweetly barking as she may be, don't rule her out yet, okay? Shall I try her again? Not just yet. Help Max try to get a handle on Fleur first. She's a vital link. Will do, Sarge.
We're just taking the psychologist, Professor O'Byrne, out to see Windrush, but ring my mobile if anything interesting shows up.
Okay, but one thing before you go.
She handed Marie a brown envelope.
This came for D.I. Jackman. It's from Forensics.
Marie took it over to where Jackman was deep in conversation with Charlie Button.
Open it, would you, Marie? I'm almost finished here.
She skimmed through the memo and felt a surge of frustration. It was a short report on the findings from the drinking club venue at the old chapel. None of the dozens of samples taken had matched any known offenders. Well, at least they had new samples on file and could use them to tie in any suspects, including one of their own.
We're ready when you are,
Jackman called out to the professor.
Get ready for your trip to the nastiest children's ward you'll ever see.
Chapter 26. As they drove out towards Roman Creek, Jackman and Henry O'Byrne talked about murders and what might bring someone to the point where they took another person's life. Jackman mostly listened. Approaching the lane that led to Windrush, Henry said, I don't believe that anyone is born evil. I do think that some people lack the capacity to understand the consequences of their actions. If they're exposed to cruelty at an early age, impressionable age, and then continue to suffer violence, neglect, or abuse as they grow, then they become desensitized. They become conditioned to believe that violence is an acceptable way to express their pent-up anger.
Do you think our killer is someone like that? Jackman asked.
The professor shook his head.
Oh, I'm just generalizing. I need to see a lot more before I start making any judgments.
They were waved through the gate. Marie was pensive.
Even after years in this job and having seen some terrible things, I'm still amazed at what people are capable of doing to one another.
The professor turned and looked at her with an expression of great sadness. Sergeant Evans, when a person lacks empathy and sees others as objects rather than human beings, they are capable of anything and will experience no remorse whatsoever. Jackman gazed out of the windscreen. What complicated animals humans were.
In our job, he said, we deal with simple criminal activity. But you have to contend with people in confused mental states. How do you cope, Professor?
Henry O'Byrne smiled.
The same way you do. It's a job. It pays the mortgage, clothes and feeds us. We may be passionate about what we do, but it's not our whole life. I'm betting that you have friends and family and love nothing better than spending time with them. His smile broadened. And it helps that we know the difference between right and wrong, as do most people. I like to believe that most people are pretty decent, all things considered, and we happen to deal with a very small minority.
Jackman opened his door and got out.
It's nice to meet an optimist. It's quite refreshing.
Believe me, optimists are all too rare in the police force. Inside the house, the professor looked around him.
I bet this was quite something once. Such a shame it's been so neglected.
Jackman's phone rang.
Jackman,
It's Rory Wilkinson. Are you free? I have something that you should know about.
Far away. Your friend Henry O'Byrne and I are out at the scene.
Rory sounded excited.
Jackman, I'm almost certain that none of our victims were actually killed in that underground room. They were all killed elsewhere and brought down the tunnel to the ward using the old trolley that we found close to the door. There were tiny particles of cloth and fabric caught on splinters in the rough wooden base of the thing.
So are we looking for another site where the actual killings took place?
I'm afraid so.
Jackman asked the question he'd been dreading.
Do you know if the victims were sexually assaulted?
With the older bodies, it's impossible to tell yet. Although Jan Wallace has compiled a very detailed report on the first girl, the one we know as Fleur. She's a completely different story, and I'll leave Jan to talk to you about her. Some of the more recent ones had certainly suffered sexual assault and possibly rape, although not all of them. The younger ones seem to have escaped that fate.
I wonder why Emily wasn't already dead. She was drugged, and had certainly put up a fight at some point, from the state of her feet and her torn clothing. But she was still alive.
I guess the murderer thought he'd killed her. You said yourself that her signs were very weak.
That was true. Jackman had felt nothing in the way of a pulse.
Jan Wallace says she will be calling you, if that's all right.
Just in case we are still down in the chamber, get her to ring the CID room. They'll take the details. And Rory, we've had a lot of response from other forces regarding the girls' identities, but we can't say that any of them are 100% positive until we get the DNA results. Any idea when that's likely to be?
It's not a straightforward, simple process, but because of the number of victims, I'm using the university and a private lab run by a colleague of mine. They deal mainly with paternity testing, but have volunteered to chip in. I can't tell you exactly when they'll be back, hopefully not long, but I'll fast-track anything of real urgency.
Make Fleur the number one priority, will you?
Sure it is. You'll realise why when you speak to Jan Wallace.
Jackman ended the call and was suddenly overcome by a feeling of unease.
Right, Henry. First stop, the crime scene.
The professor doffed an imaginary cap.
Lead on.
They spent almost an hour underground, and the psychologist was silent for most of the drive back to the station.
Such method, he said suddenly. Everything planned and laid out so perfectly. A tidy, methodical mind.
Even the beds are exactly the same distance apart.
I'm certain that if you measured those gaps, they would be perfectly equal.
What does that tell us?
Asked Jackman. Henry O'Byrne took a deep breath.
Alas, the whole setting spoke volumes.
He turned in his seat and faced Marie, his eyes shining with excitement.
I think I can show you more about the man who engineered all that than you would ever hope to get from one of your profilers. I never imagined that we'd find such a beautiful blueprint of the mind.
You said he. You're certain it's a male? Asked Jackman.
Without a doubt.
And Henry lapsed back into silence for the rest of the journey. When they returned to the CID room, Max told them that the archaeologist woman had phoned. Marie rang back immediately.
I know you're busy, detective, said Jan Wallace, but I was wondering if you could come over to the mortuary. I've got a lot of information regarding your earliest victim, Fleur. Some of it is quite complicated and needs explaining in person.
Marie winced.
I'll try, but could you give me the basic details now, and I'll get there as soon as I can. We're up to our necks here.
There was a pause.
I understand, but you should know that I counted 27 different bone injuries on that young woman. After studying the pathology of her bones, I found them to be severely lacking in minerals, and as the analysis showed malnutrition and anemia, I believe she starved to death.
Marie hadn't expected that.
I can also confirm that she was indeed disinterred. However, and this is quite remarkable, most of the skeleton is still present. Just some of the very smallest bones are missing. She was 15 when she died, which is what the name plaque says. There is quite a lot more, Sergeant, when you have the time, although nothing as important as what I have just told you.
Look, I really appreciate your help, Professor Wallace, and I'll get over to see you as soon as I've tied a few things up here, okay?
She replaced the phone, her brain running riot.
Starved to death,
she whispered to herself,
and exhumed after burial. What was going on?
Rosie sat down next to her.
You look a trifle perplexed. And so will you, Flower. Listen to this.
She called to Max and Charlie and relayed Jan Wallace's information.
Bloody hell, said Max. I know I'm supposed to be the detective, but what the hell is this all about?
No one answered. As soon as Jackman emerged from his office, Marie brought him up to date on what Jan Wallace had found. Get some refreshments organized for the professor, Marie, and tell the team to come to my office. The prof is going to give us his thoughts, and then you really should go and talk to Jan Wallace. A few moments later, they had all gathered in Jackman's office. The professor began.
Earlier, D.I. Jackman asked what the murderer's very particular attention to detail meant. Well, there is an enormous difference between an organized killer and a disorganized one. The organized killer is usually of average or above average intelligence, forensically aware and careful to select a location in which he feels comfortable. He chooses his times carefully, is well prepared, and likes to feel that he's in control. The disorganized killer, on the other hand, is often of lower intelligence, acts spontaneously and uses whatever comes to hand, so the scene that he leaves behind him can often reflect his disorganized state.
So, our man is organized? Said Marie.
The professor tilted his head to one side.
Obsessively. He had taken great care of his victims. There were no instruments of torture, no restraints, nothing to scare or threaten. Everything was clean and tidy, down to the flowers and neatly stored clothes. According to the photographs, the bodies were undisturbed and made to appear comfortable and peaceful.
That ties in with what the pathologist has told me. Forensics found nothing to show that they'd been killed there, said Jackman.
Everything in that chamber contradicts the fact that the girls were drugged, abducted, beaten, possibly sexually assaulted or raped, and then murdered.
Could he have some kind of split personality?
Asked Charlie. The professor nodded.
Multiple personality disorders are very rare, but it's a possibility. He would have different characteristics and skills, and the two personalities would most likely not be aware of each other.
Jackman rubbed at his temple thoughtfully. What would trigger the transition from one state to the other?
Generally trauma of some kind.
That would fit, Jackman said. After he's murdered his victim, the trauma of what he's done causes the second, nurturing personality to take over.
It would be very, very unusual, but not impossible.
So where would he initially take his victims after he'd drugged them?
I would suspect somewhere close by, but not the house. There was too much going on there with all the building work, and he could have been seen. And we know that he used the tunnel from the marsh to access the room, so I'd say look within a mile or so of the tunnel entrance.
And if our murderer is Michael Lee, that is where he could be hiding, added Marie.
I can't believe he'd go back there, with half the police force out looking for him. But we can't take the risk. We'd better get a search party out to the marsh and the surrounding fields before darkness falls.
Jackman glanced at his watch.
And we don't have long.
Max jumped up. I'll go and alert uniform.
Just make sure that Windrush remains under careful guard, Max. I want new officers brought in. We can't afford to leave Windrush unprotected.
We'll go, sir.
Marie looked at Jackman.
And Jan Wallace?
Better hold off until we get this search underway.
Max hurried from the room, and Jackman turned back to the professor.
Do you really think we're dealing with a man with two personalities, Henry?
It would answer a lot of questions. I'd like to know how this progressed.
So we have to know everything we can possibly discover about that first body, the one you call Fleur,
especially if she wasn't murdered.
He drew in a breath.
And D.I. Jackman, regarding what you said earlier about not going back to Windrush, not only is it well documented that killers like to return to the scene of their crime, you ought to know that As an organized criminal comes to the end of his career, he often descends into chaos. His mind cannot go on being calculating and clever forever. He is under constant pressure and begins to break down. That's when he makes mistakes and gets caught.
So you think it's possible that he will find his way back if he can?
He is by now in turmoil. His mind will be a vortex of anger, hate, and confusion. The world has turned on him, and he knows there will be no happy ending. He'll go back because he has nowhere else to go.
And even if he is breaking down, there's a very good chance that he'll think he is clever enough to take on the entire police force. As he began to digest this information, Jackman heard Rosie's phone ring. She walked quickly over to him.
That was Gary, sir. Apparently Ethan Barley has been dragging his brother Nick around all the sleazy bars and low spots in the area in an attempt to find the man who paid him to copy the chapel key.
And they got lucky?
Jackman felt a surge of excitement.
They did, sir. He rang Gary from a grotty dive on East Street in Harlan Marsh. Gary's tailing the man now. He can't afford to bring him in because it would mean the next party would be cancelled, and then we might lose our chance to take Cade down. Gary's going to keep tailing him and find out who he is and where he lives.
Excellent. But we need to be very, very careful. Nothing about this must reach Cade's ears, or we're snookered, and that cannot be allowed to happen.
Jackman looked across to see Marie staring at him. She desperately wanted Cade to pay for something he had done in the past. Jackman just wished he knew what it was.
Chapter 27. A team of uniformed officers were now scouting the area around Roman Creek, so Jackman and the team pressed on in the CID room.
"Should we bring in that vet for questioning?"
asked Max, munching thoughtfully on a sandwich.
"We've decided that Elizabeth Sewell couldn't be our killer, yet she knows someone called Fleur. Her cards are in that hellhole, and she's written almost identical cards for the animal cages at Philip Grove's veterinary practice."
"He's got a point, sir," said Rosie. "Even though I cannot see that man being a cold-blooded killer." Jackman stared at his sandwich and put it down.
"Maybe we should. He does live close to the marsh. And if we are looking for a split personality, then who knows? How would we know what to look for?"
He looked across the room to where Marie sat a little apart from them, deep in thought.
"Penny for him?"
She looked up.
"Not worth it. My thoughts are about as clear as sump oil."
She leaned back in her chair, stretched, and said,
"Okay. 12 dead girls, all born on a Wednesday, in the same room, another dead girl, but she died of starvation. One girl, Tony, abducted and lives. One other girl, Shauna, abducted and dies, but in a totally different place. Two out of three spoke of a man with dead eyes. Have any of us seen anyone with dead eyes? No, we haven't. Michael Lee has a horrible face, but his eyes are deep and very expressive. Benedict Broom has perfectly normal eyes. Elizabeth Sewell is a woman. And not one of the people that we've interviewed, and we've spoken to quite a few, had weird eyes."
She groaned loudly.
"And who the hell is Fleur?"
"It all comes back to her, doesn't it?" Jackman said.
"There is absolutely nothing on record of anyone by that name going missing," added Max miserably.
"What am I missing?"
Gary breezed in with a smile on his lips. He looked around and the smile faded.
"Well, I see things are not too good here, but at least I have a name and address for one of the drinking club organizers. It's Brendan Keefe, and he lives on the outskirts of Harlan Marsh Town. He's ours for the taking when we're ready."
"Good work, Gary. I suppose he didn't have strange eyes, did he?" asked Jackman hopefully.
"Shifty, sneaky, piggy, but strange, no."
"Pity. Sit down."
He pushed across his untouched sandwich and said, "We're still trying to fathom out who Fleur might be." Gary picked up the sandwich.
"Ah."
He bit into it gratefully, chewed, and then said,
"Not a very common name, although..."
A civilian entered the room.
Sorry to bother you, D.I. Jackman, but the duty sergeant thought you should know that the body of a white male has been found out on the edge of the marsh. It seems that it's a hanging, but because of its location he thought it might be of interest to you.
Jackman sat bolt upright. Where exactly is the location, Constable?
The old mill at Goshawk End.
Gary said,
I know it. It's between Roman Creek and Herne Point, and right inside the area we're searching for Micah Lee.
Jackman was already halfway to the door. Then you come with me, Gary, and you too, Max. It'll do you good to get some fresh Fenland air. Once in a while you need to break that chain that attaches you to your computer. He smiled at Marie. And you can have a break from dead people. You and Rosie keep chasing Fleur. Have another word with Jan Wallace. There might be something new from the forensic point of view.
I wonder if it's Micah who has killed himself, said Marie, almost to herself.
It could well be. Don't worry, I'll ring in and let you know. There wasn't much to see at the old mill, but what they did see was surprising. The body wasn't swinging slowly on a creaking rope. It was lying in a crumpled heap on the dirty floor, surrounded by broken vegetable crates.
One body. Life undeniably extinct, with rope still attached. And it's not Micah Lee, murmured Jackman.
Some sort of fight took place by the look of all this mess, said Max.
Gary shook his head.
Don't think so. Looks to me as if he climbed up these boxes. No, that's not right. They're too far away from the body.
And how did the rope become detached from the timber spar?
Max stared up to the heavy beam.
It seems sturdy, and it doesn't slope downwards.
Jackman stared at the dead man. He looked at the twisted body, thankful that the face was turned slightly away.
I think the question we should be asking is how did a dead man loosen the rope from his own broken neck?
All right. So who was here with him?
Asked Max.
If they tried to save him, then it had to be someone who cared.
Jackman looked at the configuration of the old vegetable boxes, the timber beam, and the man's body.
I'd say someone came in and found him, and then climbed up the pile of boxes and pulled the rope free of the beam. And because no one phoned this in or called an ambulance, I would guess it was someone who wanted nothing to do with the police.
Since the body isn't Micah Lee, could it have been Micah Lee that found him? Said Gary. I wonder how long ago all this happened. I'll get a shout put out that Lee may be somewhere in the area and on his toes. There are only so many places he can get to from here.
Gary moved towards the door.
Could he get to Windrush on foot? Asked Jackman.
He could, but it would mean crossing a pretty bad stretch of wetland. Best not attempt it unless you know the paths well. But he worked close to here, didn't he?
Ventured Max.
And if he knew the marsh that well, then maybe he knew about the tunnels, Jackman mused. Right now we should get back. There's nothing we can do here. Uniform will keep this place sewn up until our overstretched forensics department can sort that poor sod out and work the scene. We don't even know who he is. There's no ID on him.
As they walked back to the car, he wondered why the man had chosen to take his own life. The word that kept coming up was guilt. Guilt or desperation? Surely it was no coincidence that a man should kill himself in such close proximity to the crime scene.
There had to be a connection.
Perhaps he had done it out of despair at losing his precious girls.
I suppose it is suicide, said Max softly. He could have been assisted.
I don't think so.
Looking at the inverted V-shaped furrow in the victim's neck left by that rough rope, I'd say it was definitely a deliberate, and in his case successful, suicide. Jackman glanced back at the derelict old mill. All that was left of it was a shell of old bricks and a weather-beaten wooden door. It must have had sails at one time, but they had long gone, and luckily it was nothing like his lovely home at Mill Corner.
There's someone asking for you, Marie.
The desk sergeant pointed to a young woman sitting in the foyer.
Marie was about to tell him to get someone else to deal with her when she recognized Asher Layton's fiancée, Linda Cowley. Marie went over and sat next to her in the almost empty foyer.
"Miss Cowley, isn't it?"
The girl nodded.
"I'm so sorry to bother you, Sergeant Evans, but he's disappeared."
She tried to hold back her tears.
"Asher didn't come home last night, and he's not been at work today."
She dabbed at the perfect makeup around her eyes.
"It's not like him. He's so thoughtful. He'd never go off without telling me. Something has happened to him, I know it."
Marie thought quickly. Asher Layton had talked to the dead girl, Shauna Kelly, on more than one occasion, and he had been warned about curb crawling. They had talked to him about Shauna's death, and now he had gone missing.
"When did you see or speak to him last?" "Lunchtime yesterday. He rang to say that he had a late appointment, but he'd be home for supper."
She began to wail.
"But I went to bed really late and he never came home."
Marie promised to make some inquiries.
"I'll do what I can, but he's a responsible adult, so you do understand that I can't register him as missing."
Linda nodded and left the station, still crying. Marie walked over to the desk.
"Danny, get one of your crews to go have a word with the old Toms down on Dock Lane, would you? See what they can tell you about a man named Asher Layton, and maybe put an alert out on him. I'd like to have a quiet word with that young man."
She gave the sergeant a description of Asher and made her way towards the lifts. Things were speeding up. In fact, the flood of new developments was threatening to drown them. Time to find Jackman and tell him about this latest worrying event. As evening approached, another call came in. Gary's voice was somber.
"Uniform may have found your second crime scene, sir. It's an old caravan on a piece of land attached to the Windrush estate. The problem is they only found it because it was on fire. There are men down there and a fire chief in attendance, but there's no way they can get an appliance out there. It's just mud and cabbages all the way to the marsh."
"Who does it belong to?"
"The land belongs to a tenant farmer called Smith, but he says the old van was there long before he took it over."
"Was anyone in it?"
"They don't think so, although it's impossible to say for sure until they can get inside. The farmer is trying to get a tractor and irrigation hose down there, but it's taking time."
Jackman saw their crime scene going up in smoke. "Come on, Gary. Even if it is burnt to the ground, we need to see this."
"Okay, boss. I'll let them know we're on our way."
As Gary drove, he had the feeling he had forgotten something important. The others talked and tossed theories around, but Gary remained silent. Things were racing away from him, and he was getting left behind. They parked and trudged over the ploughed field. There was little left to see other than a charred wreck of twisted metal and warped panels. The fire officer who met them looked grim.
"I'm afraid it's not good, sir."
"Someone died in there?" Jackman asked.
No bodies. But I did find blood evidence, and from the assortment of paraphernalia inside, it looks like you have a particularly nasty crime scene here."
He grimaced.
"What's left of it?"
"What kind of paraphernalia?"
Marie asked.
"Well, it's all badly burnt, but there are the remains of leather restraints and other leather items, a black full-head mask and some other weird stuff. There are chains with ankle and wrist cuffs, all bolted to the base of the caravan. More is showing up all the time, but it's still smouldering and it's too dangerous to stay inside for long."
"I assume it was started deliberately?" asked Jackman, his voice slightly shaky.
"Oh, yes. We found the remains of an LPG gas bottle with the valve open, so we could tell that an accelerant was used in the bedroom area."
So, thought Gary, someone had done a clean-up job. Getting rid of the evidence and covering up for themselves, or someone else. He stared at the smouldering ashes and smelled the acrid stink of burning rubber.
"It all fits, doesn't it?"
said Marie.
He takes them to the caravan, does whatever he does, then kills them.
Her face was taut with anger.
And then the bastard takes the bodies over the lower marsh path, to the entrance to the tunnel, loads them onto the trolley, and wheels them down to the children's ward.
To sleep forever, whispered Gary. Or so he thought.
You know what I find worrying, said Jackman quietly, that the beast who did this could be watching. As the last flame consumes his torture chamber.
They turned from the burnt-out caravan and walked back to the car. I think we should go up to Windrush and get a report from Uniform. We no longer need men combing the area for the second crime scene, so it may be wise to get some extra manpower around the house and the tunnels, just in case the killer does what the psychologist said and returns to his lair. Chapter 28 Marie had always loved the marsh evenings. The sky was a breathtaking display of colours, and the misty shadows that spread across the water were otherworldly. Even the sounds were peaceful. Bird calls, the rustling of small animals in the undergrowth, and the wind making the tall reeds sway and dance. But tonight was different. Every shadow concealed a hidden threat, and Marie sensed something dark and menacing drawing closer in the wind off the sea. Jackman and Gary were busy checking the security status with the uniformed sergeant, and Rosie and Max were speaking to some of the foot soldiers. Marie walked across to a low wall that edged the garden. It looked over the wetlands and out to where the marsh met the wash. She could see dozens of lights and a multitude of police officers silhouetted against the evening sky, all returning from their hunt for the murderer's killing ground. She sat down in the shadow of one of the huge old oak trees that formed a barrier between the garden and the countryside beyond, and wished that this awful case would end. More than anything, she wished they could identify Fleur. Her phone started to play its lilting ringtone. It sounded like falling rain, reminding her of the Welsh hills.
I just needed to know that you are safe.
Her mother's voice made her smile.
Yes, your daughter is safe and well. And I'd like you to stay that way, sweetheart. Is it a bad time to call? It's fine. There's no one I'd rather have a call from, believe me. I got the feeling that your difficult case had turned into a nightmare. Am I right? Spot on, Mum. This is one I really need to see the back of. Well, I know you can't talk about it, but I'm wondering if you'd like me to come and stay for a few days. There's nothing I'd like more, but I'm going to say no, Mum. We are so busy that I'd never see you. Then take great care, and remember that I love you. Don't I always? Marie said. And I love you too.
She smiled and hung up. Marie had very good instincts, good peripheral vision, pretty fair hand-eye coordination, and the ability to make an instant evaluation of a situation and act accordingly. In other words, she was a copper and a motorcyclist. So when she saw the slightest flash of a reflection in the screen of her mobile as she hung up, she knew that all was not well. Jackman was some way away talking to the uniforms, and Gary was leaning on a car and speaking into his mobile. Rosie and Max were over by the house, so she was alone, or should have been. Marie made a sideways dive, hopefully away from whoever was behind her. He cannoned into her with all the force of a charging rhino. Her swift movement had unbalanced him, and they both found themselves on the ground at the base of the wall. Micah was first up, with surprising speed, and he flung himself back at her, hands outstretched towards her throat. She twisted away and rolled onto her side, but he grabbed and held onto her wrist. The grip was a vice locked shut. Marie let out a cry, but his other hand went across her mouth and cut it off. She felt her teeth slice into the soft flesh inside her lips and cheek.
You bitch! You destroyed everything. Now let's see how your family life's been torn apart.
Marie was hardly able to breathe. So I'm going to die, she thought, just like that. Then the grip slackened gradually. The blood rushing through her veins made a roaring sound in her ears. The hand across her mouth began to shake and loosen, and she gasped. She choked, fell away from her attacker, and looked up to see Gary wrestling him to the ground and snapping cuffs around his wrists. Micah's face was a mask of pain and confusion. He rocked backwards and forward and moaned as if in terrible anguish. As far as the cuffs would allow, Micah curled up into a tight ball. He dribbled and sobbed and repeated over and over,
"Oh no, please, please, no!"
Gary hauled him to his feet and called to Jackman to help him. Micah was frog-marched away from her, pushed into the back of a police car, and driven away. Jackman insisted that this time he would not go to Harlan Marsh Police Station. Marie sat for a moment, getting her breath back, mopping at her bloody mouth with a handkerchief and trying to make sense of what had just happened. Micah had been intent on killing her, but when Gary had got hold of him, he dissolved into childlike tears. Hardly the reaction she would have expected.
"Jesus, I think we know who our killer is, don't you?" said Jackman.
He knelt down beside her and put an arm around her shoulder.
"Oh, Marie, I'm so sorry. I should have stayed closer. We knew we could be out there somewhere. Are you all right?"
"My fault," she croaked. "I asked for it. I wandered off."
She coughed, and it felt like she had hot coals in her gullet. Jackman gently helped her up.
"I'll take you straight to A&E.
"No hospital."
"You really should get checked over by a medic."
"Forget it, sir. You're wasting your breath."
She gave him a pained smile.
"And believe me, I've just realized how precious breath is."
"You have a lip that makes you look like you've overdosed on Botox. You may need stitches in that."
"I don't have time, sir. There's something about all this that isn't right. All I need is to get back to the CID room where someone can make me a very strong coffee with enough sugar in it to rot every tooth in my head."
"Has anyone ever told you that you are the most stubborn and obstinate woman?"
"Yes, sir, you did, last week, and then again a few days before."
"Shut up, Marie, or I'll get someone to stitch your mouth shut."
Bill Hickey was behind with his work. With the boss away, things had backed up, especially the paperwork. He had a small office area in a converted store attached to one of the barns, and although it was late, he decided to stay on and check the invoices. Bill was a methodical man, and the heap of unopened mail was bothering him. Just as he was throwing the last torn envelope into the bin, he glanced out of the window and saw a light inside the farmhouse. The police had left some while ago, telling him that Micah Lee had been apprehended again. Mr. Tanner wasn't home yet, so who the hell... Bill jumped up, grabbed his keys from the desk, and ran around the barn and across to the house. The front door was unlocked. Bill had checked it himself after the police left, and it had been properly secured then. He frowned, took a deep breath, and slipped inside. He stood just inside the door and heard sounds coming from the upper floor. It sounded as if the intruder was in Tanner's room. For a moment, Bill was undecided what to do. He knew he should call the police, but he was curious to see who it was in the boss's bedroom. He wasn't afraid. Bill had done a stint in the army, and he still kept himself in good shape. As he moved towards the stairs, he decided to call the police after he'd got the burglar by the scruff of the neck. Bill moved carefully along the landing. He had been right about where the thief was. Tanner's door stood open, and Bill could see a hunched figure directing a torch beam at a large wooden desk in the far corner of the room. Bill was across the floor and had the man in an arm lock before the intruder even realized what was happening. He screamed and tried to wriggle away, but he was no match for Bill, who dragged him up and across to the doorway, where he switched on the light.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
Bill growled. He was staring at the terrified face of a young man.
I...
His mouth began to tremble. Bill frowned. This wasn't exactly your usual type of robber. He loosened his grip a little.
Okay. What were you after? Money?
He pointed with his free hand towards the jumble of papers and items on the desk.
Because clearly you were looking for something.
Again, he received no answer. The young man seemed to be fighting back tears. Bill's frown deepened. The intruder had no bag with him, had nothing stuffed into the pockets of his old check jacket, and seemed totally unequipped for a burglary. Then Bill remembered the front door. Unlocked, but not forced. He thrust a hand into the jacket pockets and pulled out an old-style door key, exactly the same design as the one on his own key ring.
"Who the hell are you?"
asked Bill, pushing his captive ahead of him towards the desk.
"Why have you got a key? And what were you doing with the boss's things?"
He stopped talking as his eyes fell on the items lying on the desk. Credit cards, an open wallet, a Filofax, a signet ring, and a passport. As soon as he saw the name Tanner, Bill tightened his hold on his captive and picked up the telephone.
"It's Bill Hickey, sir. He's asking for you."
Jackman listened to the hurried message, then said, "Stay there. I'll get some officers over to you straight away." He hung up and looked at the others. "That's the farm manager at Micah's lodgings. He's caught an intruder." He downed his coffee and grabbed his jacket. "Gary, ask Uniform if they could get a car over there. But from what Hickey just told me, I think our presence is required as well. You up to this, Marie?"
"Two more paracetamol and I'm good to go,"
Marie rasped. The intruder sat on the end of the bed with his head bowed. They recognized him immediately.
"Asher Layton," Jackman said incredulously. "I think you have a lot of explaining to do, don't you?"
Asher slowly looked up at him. His face was a sickly white, his hair unkempt and his eyes red and sore.
"I have nothing to say," he whispered.
"Well, I think you have," said Jackman. "What is your connection with Mr. Toby Tanner? And what were you doing with his belongings, particularly with his passport?"
Asher shook his head and remained silent.
"Sir?"
Marie was checking the items on the desk with gloved fingers. She lifted up the Filofax and turned the pages.
"There's no entry in this diary about travelling abroad, and no mention of tickets or boarding cards or flight information either."
Jackman's gaze travelled from Asher Layton to Bill Hickey.
"You said he went to Germany."
The big man shrugged and looked puzzled.
"That's what he told me. He always made his own arrangements for things like that, so I don't understand."
"Perhaps you could explain, Mr. Layton," asked Jackman icily. "Oh, yes. And your lovely fiancée has been to see us. She spoke to Sergeant Evans here. The poor girl is worried sick. I'm sure she'll be pleased to know that you're safe." He paused. "Although, I'm not sure she'll be quite so pleased about the housebreaking charge." Asher sank lower into the chair and stared at his hands clasped tightly together in his lap.
"I've nothing to say."
As Jackman tried to coax him into talking, Marie checked Tanner's belongings again. There was nothing at all to indicate that he'd gone abroad. She carefully replaced everything in its original position, ready for the Soccos to bag and tag it, then picked up the gold signet ring. It looked well worn, so why leave it behind if you were going away? In fact, why take it off at all?
"Marie?"
"Sorry, sir,"
she muttered, placing the ring back on the desk. Jackman beckoned to the two uniformed constables who were waiting by the door.
"Take Mr. Lane to the station, please."
He shot Asher a cold stare.
He might feel more like talking when he sees the accommodation we have on offer. Not exactly Granary Court.
Jackman turned to Bill Hickey.
We'll be closing this room up and I'll need you to call at the station to make a statement, sir.
Hickey nodded and accompanied the two policemen and Asher Layton down the stairs. Jackman frowned at Marie, then down at the passport.
Tanner never went abroad, did he?
No. And he disappeared just around the time we made the discovery at Windrush. I think Mr. Toby Tanner and Micah Lee were in this together.
Jackman looked at her.
But what on earth has our little curb crawler got to do with it?
Marie suddenly blinked.
Hey, what if they are all members of the drinking club?
They couldn't be, could they?
Jackman's eyes widened.
And one of the prostitutes down at Dock Street confirmed that Layton was a regular. Maybe life with his beautiful young wag isn't fulfilling enough for our Mr. Layton.
So he gets his jollies with old Toms and at illegal sex parties.
Marie smiled, then winced as her split lip opened up again. She dabbed at the bleeding but couldn't stop the smile.
And Tanner?
Jackman looked down at the signet ring, his eyes narrowing in thought.
I wonder.
He looked at Marie, and the light dawned.
The dead man. That hanged man was dressed in tough outdoor clothing, strong boots, had no ID on him and no jewellery. But I did see a pale line around his little finger.
He pointed to the signet ring.
A pinky ring, maybe?
Marie exhaled.
Tanner didn't go to Germany. He bloody killed himself, either because he couldn't live with the shame or...
Or because he knew what was hidden under Windrush.
Jackman exclaimed.
Time to get back to the station, my friend. But before we go...
He walked to the bedside table, picked up a small alarm clock, and dropped it into an evidence bag.
I'll get Rory to cross-check the prints on this with those of the hanged man.
He looked at Marie.
If we get a match, then I'm willing to bet that Tanner contacted his little friend Asher Layton and let it slip that he was planning on topping himself. God knows how Asher knew he'd be at the mill, but I'm sure he'll tell us in the fullness of time.
Marie took one last look around the room.
Asher took Tanner's ID to slow down the identification process. Naming a John Doe can take forever. So I kind of understand that. But why bring them back here?
Jackman shrugged.
Are we sure he was bringing them back? He might have been looking for something else, and planned on taking everything with him when he left.
He followed Marie to the door.
We'll have this place taken apart if we have to.
Chapter 29 The CID room was emptying out as more officers went home, but Rosie, Max, Charlie and Gary worked on. Rosie hung up the phone.
The boss is on his way back. I'll order the pizzas now, shall I?
May as well, said Max.
Extra cheese and no anchovies for me, please. He turned to Gary. How about you, Gazza?
Yes. Whatever you're having is fine.
You're quiet tonight, Gary?
Wishing you were back at Harlem Marsh?
Max smiled at him. Gary leaned back in his chair and stretched out his arms in front of him.
No bloody fear, but I am missing something, lad, and it's driving me nuts.
He looked around the office.
Why would you dig up a body and move it somewhere else?
Because I didn't want her found, said Max immediately.
But that girl, Fleur, died of malnutrition.
Rosie replaced the handset.
So he starved her to death. That's murder too.
Gary drew in a deep breath.
I suppose so.
Or,
said Charlie, scrolling up and down on his computer,
he had to dig it up.
Gary blinked.
For what reason?
Charlie looked thoughtful.
I was thinking of my mate's dog, actually. He buried the dog's ashes in the garden, and then his mum and dad decided to move. And he was gutted about leaving the dog behind, so he dug the casket up and took it with him.
Rosie chewed on a thumbnail.
That's quite possible. He could have dug her up because something was going to happen to the place where she was buried.
Gary stood up and paced around the office, stopping at the evidence boards.
Yes, that's a very good point indeed.
The phone shrilled out, and Rosie picked it up.
It's the lab.
She put her hand over the mouthpiece.
Rory Wilkinson has an urgent message for Jacko.
Then I better take it, hadn't I? Said Jackman, as he and Marie walked into the room.
Sorry, sir.
A red-faced Rosie handed him the phone.
D.I. Jackman here?
They all watched him speak, and when he hung up, five sets of eyes were staring at him expectantly.
Rory has isolated two identical and viable prints from the children's ward. There is no match on our database, but from their position, they almost certainly belong to our killer.
Where were they?
Asked Marie.
One on the underside of one of the hospital beds, and the other on a clothes rail.
Jackman pulled out a chair and sat down.
And as Marie and I have just sent him some dabs from Toby Tanner's house, we might have answers very soon.
He looked at Marie. I'd get you to tell everyone about our adventures down on the farm, but from the look of your face, I guess it really hurts to talk.
Marie raised her eyebrows and dabbed at her lip.
You're not bloody kidding, sir.
While Gary half listened to Jackman, something still niggled away in the back of his mind. It had almost come to him, and then the DI and the Sarge had arrived, and his train of thought had evaporated.
So, does this mean we have to let Benedict Broom go? Asked Max. We took his prints when we brought him in.
Not yet. Just because his prints aren't in the children's ward doesn't mean he's not involved. And we still have to wait for forensics to tell us what happened in that caravan.
Jackman shuddered.
That's one report I'm not looking forward to reading.
The pizza arrived and they ate at their desks. The initial excitement of the news about the prints had worn off. They had yet to find a suspect to tie them to. And Marie was beginning to feel the effects of having been bulldozed to the ground by the mammoth Micah Lee.
It was almost too painful to eat, but she needed food.
As Marie tried to force down a small piece of pizza, she pondered what Jan Wallace had told her about Fleur's multiple injuries. They were almost certainly the result of serious abuse. But where did you start to look when the girl had been dead for 2 decades? She managed some gooey pizza topping, washed down with coffee, and gave up on the crispy base. She couldn't get Micah's words out of her head.
You have destroyed everything.
And he had also said, let's see how your family likes being torn apart.
What family?
Was he referring to the dead girls?
You really should go home.
She had been so deep in thought that she hadn't noticed Jackman watching her.
It's easing, sir, and there is no way I'm walking out of here before you.
Remember what I said about being stubborn?
Vaguely.
There was a shout from the CID room. Marie looked through the open door and saw Gary jump from his chair. Marie pushed the picked-out pizza aside and she and Jackman went out to see what was happening. Gary let out a shaky breath.
Sorry, sir, and Sarge, but I've come to a terrible, a really awful conclusion,
he swallowed. As the team watched him open-mouthed, he said,
It's about Fleur, and Charlie's mate's dog, and a new onion processing plant.
Jackman blinked several times.
Are you sure you're all right, Gary? That didn't make a whole lot of sense.
Gary flopped back into his chair.
We were talking about reasons why you'd dig up a body, hence Charlie's mate's dog. Then Rosie said, what if something was happening to the place where the body was originally buried? And I've been racking my brains to think what has had to be pulled down to make way for something new. And that's where the onion processing plant comes in. It's a long shot, but the old house that stood on the site of the new plant had a small family graveyard.
They planned to build the plant on the Herne Point Road, didn't they? Said a perplexed Rosie.
Yes,
The ground has been raised, but the plans have been put on hold, right? Rosie nodded.